Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Insight into Healing. My name is Alexa Servodidio, and I am your host. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Tonight, I have a returning guest. I have Sergeant Jeremiah Marin on the line, and tonight is going to be part two of our scene on the heroin epidemic. Unfortunately, since last time we spoke, it has not gotten any better. There hasn't been any improvements, but I brought Sergeant Marin back to hopefully give us some more awareness, education, and tools on how we can fight this growing epidemic. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks, Alexa. Great to be back. Appreciate you having me.
Yes. Thank you. And I know we were talking before the show, and unfortunately you were saying since last time we did our show, things have actually gotten worse with the heroin epidemic.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's absolutely true. And I can only speak on behalf of what we see here in our community. And I know it's very similar and draws a lot of parallels to the neighboring communities and probably across the country. But the epidemic has worsened, and I think a lot of leaders are struggling with new approaches to kind of combat the problem. And gone are the days where we're going to address it from one jurisdiction to the other. Really, we need to take a regional approach to it now and get a lot more agencies and a variety of experiences involved to hopefully lessen the impact that the problem is having on each and every community.
And is there any, I know there's not usually like one set reason, but why do you think it's growing and growing so much at such a fast pace?
Well, one of the things is I don't believe it's been addressed the same way other narcotic problems have been addressed in communities throughout the last few decades. The cocaine problem, the crack problem, the marijuana problem, they're all came onto the scene in their own way. Unfortunately, the heroin problem right now is very much based on a prescription pill abuse problem. That's unique to this era. And when you have experts agreeing that one in four of every heroin addict has already been addicted to prescription narcotics, it kind of draws some interesting conclusions as to why that might have happened to begin with. And it really tells the story of why we're where we are right now. There's people who are addicted and they try and hide it from their family members, and that doesn't do anything to, you know, increase the chance of solving an addiction problem or entering into recovery. And, you know, it's also affecting an interesting age group. We're talking about kids from 18 years old to the early 20s. And when the problem is hidden, there's not much that families, law enforcement, or other resources can do to help. So I believe one of the number one things that as communities we can do is expose the problem, number one, and change the culture and how we're looking at this problem of addiction, change the culture and how people feel about prescription medication, and then obviously really increase the awareness of the dangers of heroin itself.
Yes. Because I think a lot of times, as you said, a lot of it is in secret. There's a lot of shame. People don't want to talk about it. And heroin is a lot different. You know, experimenting with heroin and being at a party and saying, oh, all my friends are drinking, I'm going to, you know, taste a beer, to have a beer to be cool, to fit in. It is so much different. That one time you try heroin, you test it, whatever, could one be the one time that you become addicted for life, or two, that you overdose and die from it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, they said that heroin was very recreationally used. There wasn't so much of an addiction that was connected with heroin, where now heroin's on the scene because almost based on the necessity where you have these addicts that are addicted to the other opiate-based painkillers and medications, and it's not available to them anymore. Then the natural next step is to move towards heroin, which is readily available at a fraction of the price. So that's a problem that, you know, the communities have never faced before. And it doesn't, it isn't segregated in an urban area. It's everywhere. I work in a very affluent community, and it's affecting the families and the users and the addicts here just as much, if not more, than it is in the urban areas as well.
Yes. I think also for a lot of parents out there, families out there listening, to really, really look at how much prescription medication that they have in their house, that it could start as easily as your teen or your middle schooler trying a couple of your painkillers from getting your wisdom teeth pulled or you had a serious injury, and then them becoming addicted to it.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Most, they're saying right now, studies that one in six teens have used prescription drugs in order to get high or to change their mood. Basically, speaking on behalf of painkillers and opiate-based medications. When you have, I'm not saying that someone's going to be addicted to a painkiller the first time they use it, but as a teenager who's trying to get high and partying with their friends, that's pretty much the goal when these medications are being abused. And, you know, there are programs in place. We have it here in our agency where there's medication drop boxes where there's no questions asked and you can get rid of your medications that you otherwise would just have laying around the house. That's part of a tactic that can help us prevent teens being exposed to this type of prescription drug abuse. But it's not everything. It's parents needing to teach the teens, parents needing to understand the medications and the abuse of these medications themselves. There's this whole not in my backyard syndrome that's going on. No one wants to believe that it is in their communities or it is a problem facing their family. But when I can honestly say, in my opinion, that the crime problem in our community, I'd say about over 80% of it is directly connected to a narcotic problem. It is in your backyard. And just because you may not have children that you feel are susceptible to becoming a prescription narcotic or heroin abusers, it doesn't mean that this problem isn't going to affect you. It doesn't mean that your house can't get burglarized by that narcotics user who's looking to get a quick score to find their next fix. We see that every day. We see car burglaries and house burglaries literally every single day, and most of the suspects involved are narcotics users. So it is affecting everybody. And as I mentioned before, it's one of the reasons why we need to change the way we look at this problem. We can't keep blinders on. It's really affecting all walks of life and a whole bunch of different facets of the community. So there's not necessarily one starting point. You can start with your own family. You can start with your own acknowledgement that it is a problem and do your own research. Being exposed to what I've been exposed to and addressing the problem on a case-by-case basis in the jurisdiction I work, I learned a lot, and it's very dynamic. It changes. Every day there's new statistics, there's new trends, and it is difficult to keep up with, but it's an important thing to address, and we're doing our best.
Yes. And, you know, I've been reading a lot of articles and checking things out online, and it's interesting, it's actually frightening, that these dealers of heroin are actually having like a whole promotion package. They have their own brand, their own advertising. And a lot of times these, the names, the little cute things that are on the bags are something that would a middle schooler would find cute. It kind of looks like maybe candy, or a high school student would look at it and say, oh, wow, that's really cool, that's got a fun name, and think it's something, you know, not that serious. And they do that because they know once that person tries it once, there's like, you know, an 80% chance that they're going to be coming back.
Oh, absolutely. And it's, you know, the dealers aren't dumb. They're marketing it with their own stamps. They're trying to acquire product that already is stamped a certain way. They want their users and their clients to come back for that same item based on their past experiences. Unfortunately, a lot of these individual products are so what we call stepped on or cut or diluted or had chemicals or other narcotics added to it that just because it has the same stamp on it that a user might have used, you know, 2 days prior, doesn't mean it's the same chemical makeup. And based on your tolerance, based on what you think you know about it, and based on what you think you have in your hand right now, it could be the last time you use heroin.
Yes. And I think, you know, people, users, people thinking about trying it out, it's really seeing the seriousness of what can happen with trying that. Even though you've done it 10 times and nothing's happened and you think you trust the person supposedly who makes it, I've been hearing things from parents who've lost children to heroin overdose who are still speaking to friends and peers of theirs that are still using, and that they're putting some very horrific, horrifying things they're mixing in with the heroin.
Oh, yeah, you're right. And again, it gets back to not knowing exactly what's in it. And like I said, where it might have been okay for you to use 2 days ago and your buddy used it and you trust who you're getting it from, it could be your last time using. It could be that one that's, you know, everybody says, oh, there's a certain stamp going around that may say 100% or first 48 or whatever that brand or marketing stamp was on that little fold of heroin. They say, oh, well, let's be careful of that brand. We know that one's they're all dangerous. They're all dangerous. They're all deadly. It's the only way to look at it. A seasoned addict who has a tolerance built up could be using the same brand or stamp that they've used all along, and they still don't know what the breakdown of that product is that they're putting in their arm, snorting, or smoking, and it could be what causes them to overdose. And I know we'll talk about Narcan in a little bit, but, you know, it's given people a false sense of security that they can be rescued, they can be saved, and I think that's contributing to the problem as well.
Yes, because people feel like they have their way out, or at least, you know, God forbid they overdose or have a bad reaction, that the Narcan will save them or bring them back.
That's exactly what's happening, and we're noticing that. Users are using the buddy system, so to speak, where they're with somebody who's kind of looking over them or monitoring them, where they know if they overdose, they can call 911 or bring them to a medical center, and they know Narcan's right around the corner, and it's going to bring them back. Well, it doesn't always work that way. You know, in the past less than a week, we've had 5 overdoses that we've been associated with. The neighboring communities had probably more than that, including fatal overdoses. One subject that we had been dealing with and was known to us overdosed twice in 3 days, and Narcan was used on him both of those occasions. There's another officer I know of. There's a particular female in a neighboring jurisdiction. They've brought her back 6 times with Narcan. And so is it saving lives and reducing overdoses? Absolutely. But we're treating a symptom here. We're not treating the problem. And I would never take Narcan off the street. Absolutely not. It's a great tool. It's a great, life-saving device. But we have to back up even before that. And, yes, use it as a tool in our toolbox to help save lives, but also address the underlying problem, which is the addiction in the first place, and how we should go about reducing that and lessening the impact that that has.
Yes, because I think that's really most of the battle. I mean, it's trying to get it before the addiction starts, or, you know, having awareness, having education, and starting. I've had a lot of parents come to me and say, what age do we start? Should we start in high school? You know, I don't want my child to know about it if they really don't. You know, it's pretty hard to start speaking about heroin. But as we were discussing before, third and fourth graders aren't exempt now from speaking about heroin, thinking about heroin, thinking if they're going to their friend's house, their parents have painkillers in the cabinet. They're taking them. They're becoming addicted to them. I mean, I know it's hard to even fathom that idea, but it's happening.
Well, you're right. You're right. And we're seeing it more and more, unfortunately, and the age is decreasing. The middle schoolers are who we're targeting. That's who we want to make sure they know what's going on, and their parents. We want their parents to reach out to them. My kids are all under 10 years old, and every single one of them knows they're afraid of medication. That's the way I want it. Now, it may be a little extreme. My daughter has bronchitis right now, and she got some amoxicillin from the pediatrician, and she wanted me to read it all about her, all the cautions. She wanted to make sure herself that it was okay to be taking it, and I've scared them, and rightfully so. It's a, what I've seen. I don't want any other parent to have to see, and they can't be too young for you to start explaining it if you do it the right way. And the middle schoolers, if we can't address and get it in the mind of the middle schoolers and their parents, it may be too late by the time they get to high school. We're seeing pill parties where there's no alcohol involved in these parties, but you do have to bring some type of a pill or a prescription medication. And they're throwing them in a bowl, and the kids are popping them either to be cool or peer pressure or to get high or for whatever the reason. But that could be the beginning of the downward spiral. And if they haven't been educated about the dangers and just doing that one time, it may be too late by the time they get to high school. You know, we are seeing kids are getting a lot of these prescription narcotics from their parents, from their grandparents. You know, it takes a lot of guts for someone, a possible user, to go into a projects or a bad neighborhood or a housing, you know, a housing complex to buy narcotics. But it doesn't take much thought at all to go into your grandmother's medicine cabinet and take whatever she has there. And we see that. We see people breaking into houses, whether they know the product is there or not, but there's nothing else missing except medication. So it's changing the trend in certain crime patterns. And as I mentioned before, it's connected to almost all the crime we see in our jurisdiction.
I think the addiction for heroin is so strong that even you think, oh, I would never do something like this, my child would never do something like this, that's not even the case anymore. The having the addiction to the heroin, to the prescription pill, is what drives them. They're not in control anymore. It's literally a physical reaction that if they don't get, they can have seizures, they can get very sick. So they're not even thinking rationally anymore to sit down and have a conversation about right and wrong. That's why it's so important to really speak to them before they try anything.
Oh yeah, I mean, I've yet to come across someone who said that they wanted to be addicted to heroin. However, the perception of using and abusing painkillers is still quote unquote cool. It's fun at parties. It's medication that a doctor prescribed. How bad can it be? But you don't realize that it's the same opiate-based material that you're finding in heroin. And that's why it's so easy for these addicts or the prescription painkiller abuser to turn to heroin. And then that's where the shame's involved. You know, at a party, you don't see too many people snorting a bag of heroin together and being proud of that. With this type of addiction, there is shame involved. What we've noticed is, the example I give is, you know, if your son or daughter had a brain tumor, you're going to go to the ends of the earth to try and find the best doctor to get the help they need, and whatever resource you could use, whoever's going to stand out and help you, you're not afraid to ask. However, when you find out your son or daughter is addicted to a painkiller or addicted to heroin, the number one goal seems to be you don't want your neighbors to find out. So there's a disconnect there, and I think that gets back to, again, we need to change the culture and how we look at all this. There shouldn't be shame involved. The goal should be to get these people their help and to prevent it in the first place.
Because with the heroin addiction, this is not something that they can get over on their own or come back from. They really need intensive inpatient rehab for more than a month or 2 months or just a detox. This is a very serious, lifelong battle that this person will have to be aware of.
You know, everybody's different, and I think there's no black and white, and once you're addicted, this is the course of action you need to take. You don't know how you're going to play out in treatment. But what we have seen, and as we spoke of a little earlier, you could do a 90-day inpatient, serious, intensive program, and if you don't adhere to what you've learned, what's changed about your life, and what the right thing is to do, and stick with those guidelines and the thought-out process for the rest of your life, it's very easy to relapse. We see it. We see people that the gentleman that we were dealing with a couple of weeks ago, we know he knew what would take for him to overdose, yet the it was so strong of an urge for him to continue to use heroin, not necessarily mentally but physiologically, that he continued to use and overdosed again in another couple of days. So it's the drive and the urge and is uncontrollable. And I don't think in order to enter into recovery and solve this problem and get the treatment, you're not just attending a couple of counseling sessions and hoping that it's going to go away. It doesn't work that way.
Yes. I think it's also really, you know, having for listeners, people that want to get involved, I think it's really, you know, speaking to our insurance companies, our politicians about helping with insurance to really cover these long-term stays. Because a lot of times, even if you have insurance, it does not cover most of inpatient drug rehab.
It probably doesn't, and it's an unfortunate thing, and I'm hoping the trend you'll see other treatment programs change and accommodate more insurances, and it'll be more thorough and more complex programs that people who need the help will receive. But right now, that unfortunately, that's not the case. You're right. And working in an affluent community, it's one of the reasons we don't hear about the individual cases, because the people do have the resources to ship their child out to Wyoming or to some fabulous treatment center that we never even heard of that there was a problem. But that, and that's fine. We want them to get their help. But part of the battle here and part of our goal and our approach is to know about these circumstances in the first place, so we can plan our attack. We can develop a plan to, at its inception, target people who would be addicts and prevent it in the first place. And when we don't hear about it, it makes it very difficult to, you know, kind of correct the problem or at least start heading in a direction where we could make an impact. Some of the other communities, you hear about it more because they don't have the resources. They don't have the health insurance that's going to cover a program that the particular user or addict would need. But there are a lot of programs out there. There are more that are being developed every day. And just in the little research that I've done here in Connecticut, there's a lot of resources available. There's a lot of people willing to help. Different grades of pay-for services. There's state programs. And there's a lot of resources out there, believe it or not, that anybody who wants help can receive at a very basic level. And even if that's a step in the right direction, it's something that I encourage, you know, a family member or an addict or a user themselves to reach out and ask for that help. Any local police department would hopefully be able to point you in the right direction. And then there's always, you know, the state websites and the helplines and the drug hotlines. They're gonna know a lot more about the problem is that particular addict or user is facing, and know which way to point them in the right direction.
Yeah. And it sounds like also law enforcement is more interested now in dealing with addressing the addiction than just getting someone to lock up. And I think that's what people really need to understand, that it's going beyond that, thinking, okay, let's lock up the drug addict and get them off the street. That doesn't stop the problem. I think it's really the law enforcement, all mental health coming together. It's really addressing the addiction and getting supports and network and us all working together to support and have a team.
You're right. Gone are the days of just making the street-level arrests. They've become investigations, and it's a matter of life and death, and that's the way we're looking at it now. We'd be foolish to think that we could arrest our way out of this problem. That's not what's happening, and it's not our plan, and I don't know that there's any law enforcement agency that's really looking at it like that anymore. Gone are the days in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s where someone gets pulled over and it's a user or addict or someone who has a problem and they have a little cocaine on them or they have heroin on them. We're not looking to worsen the situation for somebody. If we can help them, we're going to try and help them. And if it's something that we can use to our advantage in order to help work on the overall problem, then of course we will. There's some agencies that are making names for themselves right now with different programs where you can walk into the lobby of the police department with, you know, your heroin and your paraphernalia and say that you need help, and they're willing to, you know, properly dispose of those items and also get you the help. There's politics involved in that, but it's a great program, and it's a perfect step in the direction I think that law enforcement as an industry needs to take. The job that we do, you know, not just in battling the drug problem, but it's really changed over the past 20 years. It's not so much, you know, the street level, locking people up, putting them away, throwing away the key. It's the social work aspect of our job has really risen to the surface, and that's where we're here. We're, you know, a lot of when people don't know what to do, they end up at the doorstep of the police department. It's for a variety of reasons. So we wear different hats, and we need to know how to handle these situations. And a little, you know, ongoing joke is, you know, if you don't know how to handle a situation that's presenting itself to you, what are you going to do, call the police? And we say that to ourselves. So we need to know how, at least the first couple of steps to take with any kind of situation. And the narcotic problem right now and the prescription drug abuse problem is really stretching our resources, but we've recognized and acknowledged that it's something that is on the top of the list of priorities, and we're doing everything we can to help lessen the impact that it's having negatively on our communities.
Yes. I think also an interesting point that if say there is one heroin user, one heroin addict, there's usually many more around them. That it's not okay, we've gotten rid of one off the street. There's many of other addicts that are around, which means there's a whole network of dealers, of people supplying it, of people getting new customers. It's a whole underground, it seems, team and business that is profiting. So these dealers, these people working on the other side, they're passionate about selling their drug because they're making such a huge profit. And I think parents, addicts, loved ones need to know this is a tough battle, that it really has to be there and stand up for your loved one and get a team behind them.
You're right. And I'm sure that the addict and the user feels very lonely concerning how their family may know or not know what their problem is. They hide it from them. They hide it well. And it's tough to recognize that one of your loved ones may be addicted to painkillers or heroin. But what we've seen is most of our users and our addicts, they're dealer users as well. They're selling a little bit on the side as well just to support their habit. So if someone's buying, you know, a fold of heroin for $5 a bag, well, they may buy a bundle, which is 10, and, you know, sell 4 or 5 at $10 a bag to another buddy who trusts them, and they're recovering some funds and able to finance their own problem. And it's kind of the trend we're seeing. I'm not saying that everybody's in that situation, but even in an affluent you know, community such as the one that I work in, we're seeing people needing to support their habit because they go through thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars in a couple of years' time just to support their habit. So they have to be able to keep that going because of the addiction. And a lot of the times you'll see them buy from their supplier and move it along a few more times and try and increase the price and cover what their cost would be for their own habit.
So they just dig a deeper and deeper hole. And can imagine someone who started off, oh, I'm just going to try this, then becomes addicted and then finds themselves also selling and you know, handling all this. It's a hard thing, you know, with the guilt, with the shame, to come out and really ask for help. But it sounds like this is a common theme that's running in the heroin epidemic.
Well, one of the reasons I think that these users are turning to heroin to begin with is because their prescription pill addiction got so expensive. To buy, you know, a 10-milligram pill of OxyContin on the street, it's $10 a week. It's basically $1 a milligram. So once your tolerance is up, a 10-milligram pill is not going to do too much for you. So you're looking at the 40s, the 50s, the 80s. So that's for one pill, you're talking $40, $50, or $80. It becomes unrealistic after a while, especially when you can get the same high from a bag of heroin, which is only going to cost you $5, and that's a lot more readily available. So that has, you know, skyrocketed the problem. It's the natural tendency for people that are at a loss through addiction to turn to. And it's one of the ways that they're has been so successfully spread, if you want to put it that way, and it's really the major contributing factor in why the problem is as big as it is because heroin is the natural, easy thing to turn to, and it is so much more deadly. But unfortunately, that's what we're facing at this point.
And I'm wondering also, I know there's a lot of HIPAA and confidentiality privacy laws going on, but I'm wondering if someone has had an accident or has been on prescription pills because of an accident or an operation, if there is a way to have a screening to, you know, screen the person later on to see if they're, you know, still using, if they, you know, is there any signs? And I know there's a lot of privacy, but I'm wondering if, you know, this epidemic has become so serious that it's almost gotten to that level that privacy is costing a lot of people their lives.
You're right. And I know I've told you this before, but a couple of years back, I believe it was 2013, we had been notified by a local hospital that there was 13 overdoses of residents from our jurisdiction and our community that had been reported at that hospital. We didn't know about one of them. One of the reasons is people just get driven right to the hospital when they overdose. But you're right. I think medical practitioners need to be better educated about this. You know, I'm not obviously not a doctor, but it had been so haphazardly. The policy was just that people would get prescriptions for whatever they needed without even an examination until that kind of theory and concept dried up because the government got involved and implemented much stricter guidelines to how this medication is regulated. But maybe the patients need to be screened a little bit more, like you're saying. Maybe if someone's there could be something that, based on a point system, someone would screen too high to be prescribed a certain medication. And if that can save one person, it may be worth looking into. But something has to give one way or the other. I mean, hospitals right now, they're, at least in Connecticut, they have to notify us if someone's there for a treatment of a dog bite. But they don't have to notify us if someone dies or overdoses on heroin. It's almost backwards, and I know that's way above the authority of a law enforcement agency to enact any kind of guideline or statutory requirement, but I wouldn't be surprised if you saw some type of new regulation go into effect very soon in which hospitals do need to report you know, heroin or drug overdoses to the local law enforcement agency as a policy rather than just us finding out kind of word of mouth, which has been the way it's been going. To date.
Yes, and I think also if someone is in the need for a prescription pill before it is prescribed, that they have to sign a consent, a HIPAA violation, a HIPAA thing that they will agree to be screened. And then, you know, if after a couple of times they are not adherent to it or they don't come in, and if maybe there has been an arrest or there's been some addiction showing up, that the police can get involved in it. And I know people saying, oh, my rights, this is, it's not. And it's not about infringing on people's rights, but I think this is the seriousness. And I know if you've seen it in your job, I've seen it in my practice. It's gotten to that point that, unfortunately, privacy and rights have to be put on the side. And I know that's very controversial, but when it comes to your loved one or your family member, this could save their life. This is a life or death thing that's going on.
You're right. And you know, I think it's that part of it, the politics involved of it is a little slower moving than we want it to be. I mean, there's prescription monitoring programs that we have access to. So, for example, if we come across someone who may have some prescriptions on their person that may not have been bottled or contained properly or wasn't in their name, we can check their name in the databases and we can see what prescriptions they're entitled to, when they filled them, how often they get them filled, who the doctor was, and where the pharmacy is that they actually picked them up. But it's amazing to me still that the same people you can see where prescriptions they're getting are from different doctors, dates that are in such close proximity. You know that first prescription wouldn't have run out, so you can see a level of abuse right there or a level of sale right there. And there just isn't anything in place just yet that throws throws up enough of a red flag that that next doctor would already know and say, hey, this person's either doctor shopping or has a problem, and we should hold back on giving them the prescription that they're asking for. And then throw in the whole them trying to use fraudulent prescriptions at the pharmacies and counterfeit prescriptions. And there's ins and outs and ways around everything. But the regulations, some of them are very new. It's difficult for law enforcement to enforce. And, you know, there's a disconnect, again, between the medical community and the law enforcement community. But unfortunately, with this type of a problem, we're going to be forced to kind of mesh together and work together. And it's obviously for a great reason. But there just isn't anything that's foolproof in place right now that can, you know, otherwise take the place of some type of a patient screening or, you know, an education program for doctors, and then it's still lending to how bad this problem is right now on a global level, I would say. So I'm hoping that the government gets involved a little further, not only to make our job a little easier, but to save lives. We, again, are working backwards on this problem. We're seeing the final outcomes. We're seeing the overdoses. We're seeing the people being hurt during narcotics transactions. We're seeing the money loss, the breakups of the families. And we're treating it almost reactively, and we want to treat it proactively. And our hands are tied somewhat without stricter adherence to regulations or new regulations and how, number one, prescription medication is dealt out to potential addicts, and then number two, maybe we need some stricter punishment and sanctions against those who are dealing street level narcotics.
Yes, we actually have a question in the chat room. So how much of this epidemic is being blamed on Big Pharma?
Pharmaceuticals. You know, that's above my pay grade to actually comment on that, but I mean, it's natural to think that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that's where the money was. The money was really in these medications and, you know, supported by medical professionals prescribing them and handing them out. They're, you know, it's fixing everybody's problems, yet it's caused more problems and problems on top of problems. So it's tough for me to put a number or even my finger on what exactly would be the problem, but, you know, there's a lot to blame. There's the availability of those narcotics and the availability of the prescription drugs, but there's also the problem of parents not being parents. If we're saying here that, you know, kids are becoming addicted in their teenage years because of what they found in their parents' medicine cabinets, well, you have two things going on there. You have the parents not being responsible about how they house and secure their medications, but you also may have a lack of awareness of how this problem can flare up in your own child. So there's that whole level of what's causing this problem. You can't say that these medications, there's no need for them, because of course they're life-saving medications in a lot of circumstances, but the potential and the propensity for them to be abused has obviously shown its face, and that's been the cause and effect to what we're facing present day.
Yes. I think it's also, you know, gets to that point, too, where it's not where parents can't say kids will be kids. You know, they're younger. We all went into our parents' liquor cabinets or experimented. This is not what we're talking about. This is really, you know, not kids being kids. This is something that's really seriously going on.
Oh, yeah. It's and I know that's part of being a parent, recognizing what the new trends, what the new problems are. I mean, the communications, the way the kids have now with the texting and the different social media apps, it's near impossible to keep up with. And we're pretty good with the officers in my office who, you know, are pretty hip to what's the newest trend in communicating. But how can you keep up with everything, especially as a parent? Well, you need to be involved, number one. And number two, you need to recognize some of the red flags. So it's hard. I'm not saying any of this is easy, but it's so scary, and so many of the things I saw were or have seen are preventable. you know, that's the message I'm trying to get across. I mean, it breaks your heart when you knock on somebody's door because you know that their child is selling their personal belongings and electronics and jewelry of their parents in pawn shops, because we see the pawn lists. And when we knock on the parent's door and say, hey, do you know your daughter just sold your high school class ring? And they don't believe it. And when they go to look for the class ring and it's gone, then this becomes the first indication that they had that they received that their child had some type of a narcotic problem. So, yeah, could we have set up on that person and possibly got them caught up in some type of a drug transaction? Yeah, but that's not what we're doing anymore. We're looking to help. We're looking to head things off at the pass. And, you know, if we can recognize a problem, we're going to bring it to the attention of their parents. And where we can help, we always will. And that's a reality of what's going on right now. A lot of the times, parents don't know that their kids have a problem. A husband may not know a wife has a problem, and a wife may not know the husband has a problem until we're involved some way. And there's a morality issue here, too, where, yeah, do we have to enforce, you know, criminal statutes? Yeah, but if we can save a life, we're, of course, going to do that as well, too, and we're going to do that first. So it is new. It's a new approach, but it's a new problem to society right now. So everybody's trying to figure it out in their own way. But the quicker we can get everybody on the same page, I think the quicker we can make an impact to the epidemic.
Yes. And I know we brought up earlier about Narcan, and, you know, I guess some people think that this will save everyone who overdoses. Is this a case with Narcan? I mean, is it for just one type of heroin? Is it for people who have certain reactions to heroin? I mean, what is Narcan and how much does it really work?
Well, it is a great tool. And it's come on the scene relatively recently. But basically, Narcan is a brand name for naloxone, which is a medication that reverses the effects of the opioid. Typically, and what we see most of the time is you have a depression and a respiratory depression, and that's basically someone's either slowing in their breathing or they cease breathing altogether. And by administering this drug, and what we have in our community is it's a liquid. It's administered through the nose. It almost immediately, if the person is not too far gone in their overdose, it can allow for normal breathing to return, and basically reverse the effects of what the opioid has had. So, as I mentioned before, we're seeing addicts and users kind of have that in their back pocket, so to speak, and think that, well, my addiction is so strong and the urge, I need this, not even to get high anymore, but just to feel normal so I'm not going through withdrawal. It doesn't matter if I overdose, they're going to bring me back. I mean, we've seen people brought back where they're fighting with us and literally upset with us that we brought them back from the high that they had, because now they're going to be going through the withdrawals, and they're alive, but they're upset with us because we brought them back. So unfortunately, it doesn't work for everybody. And, you know, we have two young people in our community right now that are on ventilators as a result of overdoses over the past 2 weeks. And their fate is unknown at this point. You know, in neighboring towns next door and within close proximity of where I work, they've had fatal overdoses in the last couple of weeks. And this isn't, you know, unique to where we're working here. It's not unique to any state. It's not unique to any type of demographic. It's everywhere. And you know, law enforcement agencies can trade statistics all day long, and we're finding that it's similar. Some areas have more severe problems than others, but we're all experiencing it. And I think most jurisdictions are at a loss somewhat and looking for answers. And I think what everybody's kind of doing and what we're doing is we got to back it up. We need to get the help to everybody first and battle the problem before it's an addiction. And if we can do that, we're going to have the desired impact, but it begins with the awareness, teaching everybody about what's happening, how it's happening, and the severity of what it can turn into. I read an article the other day, and it's unfortunate, but it's the truth. You don't see too many heroin addicts that have gray hair. There's not too many options once somebody's addicted to heroin. It's either recovery or it's death, and there's not a lot of in the middle. So it's that serious. It's the way everybody needs to look at it. And if we can impress upon the community that this is what needs to be done when, at a young age, and these are the precautions that need to be taken, then that's what we're going to do.
Yeah. And is there any way also to maybe up the sentences, the punishments for dealers, for people who are caught selling, dealing, who are ongoing, who've had a history of selling heroin, selling prescription pills, making the penalties a lot higher? Because I think that, say, Sam, sometimes, you know, you put one away, there's another 10 on the street.
Oh, you're right. I can't speak on behalf of what's going on with the rest of the country or even the rest of the state, but I know in Fairfield County, what's happening is in the courts, the sentences and the way it's looked at if you're a dealer versus someone who's just caught with possession of the narcotic varies. They look at it much more seriously if you're dealing in a narcotic versus if you were just caught because you're a user and an addict. It's becoming pretty easily to recognize who's who and what they're doing, even though, you know, there are those users that are dealing, quote unquote, just to support their habit. But, you know, I don't know that there's proof necessarily that a more severe sentence for a dealer is going to deter them from doing what the only thing that they know or their only source of income or, you know, what they've been doing for as long as they've been doing. I'm sure it would have some type of effect. Again, that's one of those things that's above my pay grade. This problem has presented so many new facets of law enforcement and treatment programs and just how the approaches we need to take and how communities need to take. I think everybody's still trying to figure out, and that's including the courts. When you're dealing with house burglaries and it's because you're a heroin addict, you know, I don't know exactly how the court is looking at that right now. It's all kind of connected, but I do know that there isn't any really affirmative defense to why you're dealing heroin and you're contributing to this problem. So that is looked at extremely seriously in our jurisdiction, and I know it will continue to do so.
Yes. And I think also the stereotype of, you know, kids or people going to these bad neighborhoods to get heroin is not the case anymore. A lot of people that I've worked with in the practice, the heroin dealers are coming to the affluent country. They know this is where they're going. They're traveling to the addicts because they know they have such a high rate.
You're exactly right. It's lucrative for them. They're going to where the money is. They're creating more addicts, and it's worth it for them. It's a problem we face. It's a problem we're on another level we're addressing, and it's just one of those things. That part of it's the business part of it that we need to have an impact on, and there is so much money involved in it that it presents a whole host of different moving parts that need to be addressed. You know, in the communications, as I mentioned before, it's so easy to text and Facebook and tweet and all these different apps. It's the access to dealers and the access to friends and the access to the product essentially is very easy. And in a lot of cases, it's right under our nose. It's right under a user's parents' nose, and it's in every community, as you said. So, you know, in an inner city type environment where a fold of heroin may only cost $5, well, you drive less than a minute and a half to the next town over and you may be selling it for $12. And that's what makes it worth it for the dealer. And I think that's the drive behind it at this point. No pun intended.
Yes. And I know there's also been, you know, an epidemic too of these dealers, of people coming outside the rehabs, outside, you know, the methadone clinics, and buying the medication from these people, and having the heroin available to them. And I think it's also, you know, is there having more security around rehabs and where rehabs are, and you know, who's able to be around that neighborhood. And I think really also having, you know, neighborhood watches or something that people can really get involved, because it sounds like, you know, these dealers are really, you know, banking in on everything.
I mean, you're right. That would be the natural susceptible target for the dealers, and that's an easy way for them to make money. But the sad thing is, Alexa, they don't need to target those people. There's so many out there, and there's so many in every community. They're coming to them. They don't even need to go out and find them, and that's what we're seeing. You know, we know of dealers, on occasion, they can turn away a potential client or customer just because they might not have the product on them, and it's not hurting their business. Their buddies are dealing too. They're referring them. It's just amazing the networking that's going on, and the availability, again, of the product is so high that it doesn't matter to them. There's more to go around, and unfortunately, there's more customers to go around as well, and it's obviously fueling this problem. And one of the things, again, we're trying to make an impact on.
Now, are the dealers, I mean, how are they getting the heroin? Are they mixing it and making it themselves? Are they buying it from another country? Are they from prescription pills? I mean, how are they getting their hands on this drug so readily?
Well, believe it or not, a lot of the, you know, you go up the chain a little bit, and you never really actually meet the supply level, so to speak, but you know, one dealer rats on the next dealer or gives a name of who they got it from, and there's always another guy. There's always another guy. Where do you stop? And where you stop sometimes is out of the hands of a local law enforcement or even a state law enforcement agency. But in every chance that we can, we try and, you know, head for the source. The source is the main part of the problem, but that's not, It's a lot easier said than done. And when you're dealing with multiple street-level individuals who also have a habit themselves, no one's really the dealer, or everybody's the dealer. It's hard to decipher between them. You're either having someone who's just an addict, or, like I said, what we're seeing is you have the people that are moving product themselves just to support their own habit. And it's kind of the natural progression for this addiction. And it's I don't think, you know, we're really looking at people or a mid-level narcotics dealer needing to kind of dilute their product to make more money. It's just, it simply is, there's so much of it to go around, and there's so many people with addiction problems that they're just, as quick as it's coming into them, as quick as it's being sold out to their customers and their clients.
It's frightening, just frightening how huge this epidemic has really become.
Well, you know that, you know, we deal with statistics and trying to measure our impact that we're having, and statistics can't even keep up with what's going on. We're given statistics every couple of months, Connecticut-based statistics, let's say, and, you know, they give us month by month how many fatal overdoses Connecticut has had. So let's say, for example, in April, we get January, February, and March's statistics, and they say we've had 30, so to, you know, just hypothetically, 30 overdoses, fatal overdoses in Connecticut in those 3 months, 10 a month. Well, another 3 months goes by, the Office of the Medical Examiner gets to look into more of the cases that they've had, more of the deaths that they've been investigating, and now those first 3 months from January, February, and March aren't at 30. They're at 60, and that's the reality of it. It takes a while for these cases to come through and be processed, and, you know, in the last couple of years, I believe that the increase in fatal heroin overdoses has been over 200% each year, and we are on course right now to have far, you know, go past that. I believe through July right now, there is 188 overdose deaths just in Connecticut based on either fentanyl-related or heroin-related. And that was July. So what I expect is at the end of November, when we get another report, just those up to July statistics will be inflated again when they've gotten conclusive results for investigations that they're working on currently, or were by the last, or hadn't finished by the last time the last report went out. It's unfortunate, but it's exactly what's happened in the last 4 years, and I don't see it slowing down now. And Connecticut is on pace right now to blow all those statistics out of the water, unfortunately. But hopefully this will be the last year where those percentages are so high.
So my listeners now, I guess what they can do is really getting awareness, getting education. I know in your area you do a lot of parent education and workshops for community members to come together and start to learn more about this addiction.
We've had several programs we put in place, and we started with talking to groups of school kids that were part of certain organizations through teen centers, things of that sort. Then it moved to their parents, all volunteer programs, and now we've kind of teamed up with doctors, former addicts, people that work in volunteer centers, and we really developed a program where we think we're having an impact on a lot of different levels with people who had no idea what was going on or what is going on. And we're hoping that can grow. We're hoping to broaden our audiences, and we know that we're having an impact to the with the people that we're speaking to. It's just we need to get it across to more people. So that's one of the ways that, you know, we're moving forward with it. But, you know, people have to take some ownership of it themselves. They have to do the research. There's pamphlets, there's literature, there's websites, there's programs available. People they're going to need to want to seek this stuff out if it really matters that much to them. And part of our job is to make sure that they know it should matter to them.
Yes, yes. Well, again, thank you so much for being on the show tonight. And it's just, again, so educational. And I hope that someone listening to this show learned something or we saved someone's life, or someone could save someone else's life with all everything that they've learned tonight on the show.
Well, I hope so, too. And I hope that the next time that you have me, if I'm lucky enough, that we'll be able to report some more positive things.
Yes, I was just about to say that. I was saying third time is a charm. I'm hoping to have you back again and to really have a huge impact and say that there's been an improvement and really make a dent in this horrible epidemic. And, you know, I just commend you for all the work that you're doing and your passion and your dedication to it. It really shines through.
Well, thanks, Alexa. It's people like you that have enabled people like me to be able to try and get the message out. So I appreciate that as well. And again, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And again, thank you everyone for tuning in tonight. If you have any questions, you can send them to insightintohealing@gmail.com, or you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/insightintohealing. Again, thank you everyone for tuning in. Have a good night and God bless.